You're listening to the Useful Science Podcast. This is episode 19, recorded on December 7th, 2017. This week, we're talking about expensive headphones and audio quality. Useful Science is a website where we post one-sentence summaries of scientific research relevant to your everyday life. On this podcast, we bring on a rotating panel of scientists and enthusiasts to discuss a few of our favorite articles. We go past the headlines and dig deep into the actual research to figure out how it can benefit you in your everyday life. Let's meet our hosts for this week.
Hi, I'm Thanasi. I'm a PhD student at MIT working on underwater sensing and underwater acoustics.
Hi, I'm Kevin. I completed my PhD in pharmacology and therapeutics at McGill. And since then, I've transitioned into the video game industry, where I work as a game designer at Toot Games.
Hi, I'm Jamie. I have a PhD in neuroscience, and I am a scientist at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research.
And I'm Cameron Spencer. I'm not a scientist. I'm a web developer and web designer, and I work on the Useful Science website. So, Thanasi, what are we talking about today?
So today we're covering a paper that starts on a simple premise. It asks, is there a difference between more and less expensive headphones? The full paper title is No Correlation Between Headphone Frequency Response and Retail Price, and it's by Joran Breibart, a scientist and engineer with Dolby out in Australia. And so for a lot of our listeners, I know for me, this is an important question, because there's a lot of variety in headphones that are out there. And just on some of the market research he presents in the paper, there were 11 billion headphones sold last year. So are the more expensive ones really worth it? Some customer choice stuff has seemed to say that most of the time people tend to buy headphones based on wireless connectivity, shape, and design and comfort. But there's still an important aspect of it, which is how do they sound? So instead of just going around and asking people what they think, like some previous studies have done, this paper takes a bit of a different approach. And it builds off quantitative ideas in acoustics and statistics to ask, is there some sort of a measurable difference between the different headphones? And so the way that he does this is with a tool or with something called the frequency response of the headphones that he measures. And so the frequency response, for those who aren't familiar, you can think of it like an equalizer. You've got your kind of your low frequencies, your bass. You've got your mid-range, which is kind of where vocals and other instruments lie. And then you have your treble, which is more or less how you get some clarity and brightness to sound, how you get distinction between different sounds. And so thinking of that on a little bit of a finer grain scale, there you can actually measure how well any given speaker can produce those sounds and then... towards the end of the paper, what he does is he goes ahead and asks, is one better than the other for any reason?
Could you define better?
Yeah. So, better is an interesting and sometimes difficult to quantify. A lot of studies in the past have actually just asked people and they've basically presented different frequency responses, to people. They've been able to produce different sounds through different speakers and ask people which ones they prefer. And so one of the ways that he compares the different headphones in this paper is he just compares them to that sort of gold standard based on the experiments with people's preference. Another way that you can look at it, though, is that one of the ways that sound works is that basically if a speaker can produce sounds in each of these ranges very well with kind of an even, you know, they can, it's just as easy for the speaker to produce a low frequency note as it is a high frequency note, then you can always turn down the volume a little bit on your own in the software or in the mixing studio to get things to sound the way you want. But if the speaker inherently cannot produce a good bass sound, then no matter how well it's tuned in the studio, you're never going to get a good reproduction of that on your headphones. So those are two different ways you can think about better. One based on what people think, and then the other one, are there some sort of physical limitations to how reliably the headphone can reproduce the intention of the musician or the audio engineer?
So just a quick question. In those circumstances when maybe you have like a lower quality headphone, you just simply won't hear those frequencies at all. Like they just don't exist, basically.
Right. And so I think one of the best ways to get at this is if you've ever been to a big concert where they have these massive speakers, these huge subwoofers, the way you generally generate low sounds is you have to move a lot of air back and forth. And so gigantic subwoofers, the kind that you will really only get at big concerts, are really good at that in ways that the headphones that you wear in day to day are not going to be able to do. So you're never going to get the kind of bone rattling bass sound out of your headphones, no matter how hard you try. It can just never reproduce that. And so the way that he goes about doing this is he tests almost 300 different headphones priced between $5 and $5,000, a really wide range of headphone costs, in three different styles: in-ear kind of earbuds, on-ear ones that sit right on your ear, and then the around the ear or circumoral headphones that totally encase your ear and just kind of sit on the side of your head.
For the in-ear ones, like that, there's a big range there. It could be like the Apple headphones you get with your iPhone,
yep.
Or it could be the ones that actually insert into the ear and create a seal.
Yep. Yeah. And this is actually one of the limitations of the study that I'll get into in a minute. But it seems like he tested quite a wide variety, from the ones, you know, a $5 pair without a name brand that you could probably buy on Amazon, up to, you know, through your typical Apple ones, to fancier ones that have tighter seals and things like that.
Yeah, the ones that go like into your ear canal that have sort of like a rubber gasket or a foam gasket, like those seem like they're pretty well regarded, and it'd be strange to put them in the same category as your free Apple headphones.
Yeah. Although it's interesting, the Apple headphones, people maybe just love them because they come with the iPhones and the iPods, but they've done some interesting design work, and if you've watched them evolve over time, they've actually taken on new shapes that are meant to better fit into your ear and be a little bit more ergonomic for your ear while also providing a better sound response.
Yeah. Yeah. I called them free, but I think they're like $30 in the store.
Yeah. If you were to try to replace them,
they only feel like they're free because they came in the box with their $1,000 cell phone. So
it's exactly.
Like a little bonus.
And so in order to test all of these, one of the things that I think is coolest about this paper is they actually have a dummy head, like a human head that's synthetic and is designed for acoustics experiments and acoustics experiments only. And what they do is they stick the headphones on the dummy, and there are microphones inside to try to listen and see how a human listener would receive that sound. And the idea there is that your head is a big blob of water and proteins and bone that affects how sound moves around. So you'll get a more realistic sound experience by putting the headphones on something that's shaped and maybe has some of the same kind of densities as the human head. This also leads to one of the possible limitations of the study, because one thing that he points out is that it's a lot easier to get in-ear headphones to seal really nicely in a rubber dummy head than it is for most people. So he says that one thing to look out for, and that could use some follow-up work, would be to check whether or not the results change if you don't have as good seals. Just like you were saying, Cameron.
I bet it'll make a big difference.
Just to follow up on that, is it, you'll have to forgive my ignorance here, but is it well understood why having the tighter seal gives you like a higher quality of sound, because less air escapes or something from the vibrations?
That's a good question. I think that part of it could have to do with air being able to escape, and then because you probably have small gaps between the headphone and your ear itself, only certain frequencies will kind of be able to slip out a little bit more easily than others. So that will change the response overall.
But that can't be good for people's ears.
If they crank the volume, no. I think part of the idea is that if you have a really good seal, you don't actually need as much volume because you also don't have any other external noise coming in.
Doesn't it also make your ears a little more waxy? Like if you plug your ears up consistently, then you're going to need to clean your ears out more frequently.
That's a good question. I haven't seen anything on that front, and maybe I don't wear my headphones enough to notice that kind of issue, but I don't know, maybe some of our listeners could comment in on that front.
I have a pair of nice kind of in-ear headphones like that. I think they're Edimotics. And it's actually disconcerting how much sound they block out. Like, I don't like wearing them in public because I'm afraid I'm going to get snuck up on or something.
Yeah.
So I don't have to have my music very loud at all.
Yeah, I have these nice little compressible foam pads on mine. And similarly, when I have both headphones in, it really blocks everything around. I think one of the other reasons, and this might actually be a bit more important, is that kind of having a good seal, especially if it's with foam, can be helpful, is that when you have that kind of foam contact and not so much of a rigid contact with the wall of your ear, you'll actually the headphone gets to float a little bit more freely, and so you don't have as much coupling between the headphone body itself and your ear, so it can respond the way it was sort of designed to without having variation person to person. So yeah, a couple different reasons why it might be better, but at the end of the day, a lot of these kinds of intricate details of frequency responses tend to be hard to predict without more experiments, because a lot of things can end up affecting them.
So are the researchers looking for accuracy of frequency response?
So I think that's in audio communities, that's usually a common metric to say that the more accurate a frequency response is, or the flatter a frequency response is, the better. And so he ties in some of those ideas, but he doesn't set that as a clear objective.
Yeah, because I think a lot of consumers would put on a pair of Beats by Dr. Dre.
Yeah.
Dr. Beats, a metronome brand. Beats by Dr. Dre. And would love them, and then an audio engineer would put them on and feel like there was too much bass.
Yeah, and actually,
it's also subjective.
Something interesting I've heard about the Beats headphones, and I haven't dug into it enough, but that they add some weight to it internally in the design to make them feel heavier, make them feel sturdier, so you feel like you're really paying for a much more valuable headphone.
Same as how with vacuums, they make vacuums sound aggressive, even though you could have a quieter vacuum that has just as much suction power.
Oh, that's great. That's amazing. That's an amazing anecdote. I love that.
Yeah.
This is a stupid anecdote. You ever get like a new remote control for a device and you're like, this flimsy piece of junk, and then you put the batteries in it and you're like, oh, actually, this is a pretty nice remote control. I've had that experience so many times with various bits of electronics where I thought it was junk until I had the weight of batteries in it.
Yeah. So diving into some of the results of what he found, the first question he asked is, what is the average or the typical headphone response for each style, whether the in-ear, the on-the-ear, around the ear? And then again, for different price ranges. And what he found was that there's not a ton of variation. None of the headphones produce a particularly flat response, meaning that they produce all frequencies with the same kind of loudness, but they all exhibit a sort of a wavy structure that pretty consistently, which is tied to how they generate the sound and the typical shapes and sizes of the headphones themselves. Some of the things that he did find out, though, is that the in-ear headphones actually have a little bit of a better bass response, And this was one of the things that he attributed to having a good seal in that artificial ear, was that it just makes it easier and more effective at producing those bass notes inside your ear cavity, or the dummy's ear cavity.
That's pretty amazing, because the driver, the little speaker in those headphones, has got to be a couple millimeters wide versus the big over-ear ones.
Yeah.
The big over-ear ones might be like an inch or two wide. That's a surprising outcome.
Yeah. So that's something that I didn't expect either, for the same reason. But, and then what he said was, when looking at them across the cost groups, most of what the difference was in terms of kind of how flat the frequency response was. So none of them were particularly flat, but as you went to lower and lower cost, they ended up being, it seemed to be that they were a little bit more wiggly in the low frequency. And so what that means is that for a fixed volume level on your computer or on your phone, the cheaper headphones will produce worse bass sounds. They won't produce them as strongly. You won't really feel that beat or a bass line in a song as well. This was kind of the first pass at, can we notice anything different? And aside from the bass performance, there wasn't a lot that was really easy to quantify. And so what he did next was a really cool statistical technique or math technique that's called principal component analysis. And basically, it's a way to find patterns in data that you might not be able to pick up on your own. And so when you have a big data set, like here he has the 300 different kinds of headphones, the principal component analysis sort of answers a question of, in what ways do these headphones differ most? And then what ways do they differ second most and third most and so on and so forth? And when you look at it like that, you can actually say, you can construct a picture of what is the most similar behavior of all these headphones, and what is the sort of average response, which he already did. And then you can flip that and say, now, what are the next most important characteristics of how they vary? And so the things that he found were important through this technique were that were after that kind of that average response, which is just set by more or less the geometry and the materials that they're using, the spectral tilt, so the flatness and or better bass response for the fixed volume, is the next largest differentiator among the headphones in general. Now, there didn't seem to be any correlation to that with price, but across all of the headphones, that was the thing that some were really good at and some were really. And so this is kind of where the meat of the argument comes in, where he really can claim, look, these are the features that distinguish these 300 pairs of headphones the most. And of these kind of key identifiers, none of them correlate well with price, right? It's sort of like a random looking distribution.
So do we have some consumer advice takeaway? It kind of sounds like we don't.
Not from this. So from this paper, I guess what I would say is that most headphones are going to be pretty similar, and that there's not a really well quantified difference between them. That said, I would always recommend you try it yourself, because you're always will be the best judge of whether you like one sound better versus another. But if you know nothing about it and you're just wondering whether or not you should dive into those expensive headphones, the science says probably not.
So when you guys are shopping for headphones, what is the price range that you're looking at? And what is the top thing on your list of concerns for that headphone to have?
Does anybody else have a strong opinion on this?
Well, I have a variety of headphones for a variety of uses. I basically have like my everyday headphones, I have my loud environment headphones, and I have my audio mixing headphones. So for everyday, I just use the Apple headphones because it's simple and cheap and comfortable for me. But those don't work great on a bus because you can't hear your music. So I've got some of those in-ear headphones I talked about, the Edimotics, which is basically...
So those are more like noise canceling?
They don't have any active noise canceling. They just create a nice seal and kind of block things out from around you. And then I've got a pair of over-ear headphones that I use when I'm editing stuff, because there's, you know, my goal is to find something that's going to have like a pretty even representation of the sound I'm hearing. So if what it sounds like to me is what it's going to sound like to most people, as opposed to like if I have some headphones with no bass, then I pump all the bass up in the mix, then that's not going to be nice for people who have other headphones. And my price range is like $30 to $200. It's kind of around what I've spent on headphones.
Yeah, I'd say I'm pretty similar in terms of the cost range that I've looked at for everyday kind of stuff. One thing that I really don't like is too much bass. It can lose the overall quality and balance of sound. So I like things to sound really clear and crisp. And so that's usually what I'm looking for.
Okay. I usually am just interested in how long the headphones are going to last while I'm running before my sweat corrodes through them and they start shocking me when I wear them.
So there's your problem. You just got to stop running. That's what I did. And then you're not going to have that problem anymore.
So you like the in-ear headphones then for running?
I mean, I really don't care. The in-ear ear ones fall out. Maybe the ones that suction cup in would be better, but I don't really want to get hit by a car because I can't hear.
Yeah.
You know, the ones that go like over your head seem to work the best. But even so, eventually, and I will buy my headphones, like the last pair I bought at the grocery store. So, like, I'm just interested in whether at least one of the earbuds plays noise.
Okay. So,
I know that you said noise and not music or sound.
I mean, same difference.
You know, I think a lot of people buy their headphones based on what they look like. You know,
so this is what consumer studies have shown multiple times, based on what they look like, on wireless connectivity is increasingly important to a lot of people, understandably. Shape and then the comfort. You know, you don't want to wear something if you expect to wear things for a long time, or you travel a lot and you know you want them for travel, maybe they need to be compact. Right, all these different factors come in, and I think for most people, much more than the sound quality, because like we're seeing, most things sound pretty similar.
Well, you know, one of the reasons a lot of women wear headphones is to just keep people from talking to them on the streets.
I do that whenever I'm on like the bus or on a plane, just like. You never have to have a conversation with someone if you just throw your headphones on.
Yeah, like if you got like, you know, if you're bored someday and you want to head into the feminist internet, you can find all these like blog posts and articles about the best headphones to keep men from talking to you, or stories about how headphones either work or don't work when trying to dissuade people in public from striking up a conversation with you.
Another strategy that works is the pretend to sleep strategy. I've employed that a couple times, and it works quite well.
I always miss my bus stop when I try that one.
Well, I think my consumer advice is going to be, let's just embrace the subjective nature of all this. And, you know, if you buy your headphones because they look cool, or because they make you feel good, or because they like you like the way they make your music sound, I think that that's fine.
Yeah.
You know?
I think for consumer advice, that is a consistently going to produce better results than trying to pull something out of this data.
So Kevin, let's move on to your story.
Right. So today I want to talk about a paper. It's called A Meta-Analysis of High Resolution Audio Perceptual Evaluation. This was written by Joshua D. Rice, and it was published in the June 2016 edition of Audio Engineering Society. So this was really interesting. I kind of like always considered myself as someone that appreciated good audio. I always listen to music and podcasts like when I'm traveling or doing work. And as I read this paper and read a bunch of more citations and read more on the forums and stuff, I realized that I knew nothing about audio quality. So this whole experience has been me like going down the rabbit hole and learning so many things about what it means to be an audiophile and like what audiophiles actually believe. And then the science behind that, is it true or is it not? So I think this is going to be a really interesting paper to discuss, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys think about it as well. So just generally, the whole premise of the paper, it's a meta-analysis. And the general question is, can people hear the difference between standard audio quality? So this is something that you would hear on like a CD or a DVD. And if you want to get more technical, that means that the audio is recorded at 16 bits and has between 44.1 or 48 kilohertz sampling rate. We can go into more detail with that if we want to in the discussion, but just for the sake of simplicity, that's what standard audio is. And high resolution audio is something higher than that. So an example would be, you can download music using this Ponyo. It's a device. And their entire media library that you can download is 24 bits and it's recorded at 192 kilohertz sampling rate. So it's like significantly larger files with much more audio data. And the question is, can you actually hear a difference between a normal CD and these like high resolution audio files?
Yeah, Kevin, we're setting a pretty high bar because that standard quality is already higher than I think what 90% of people are listening to. Because a CD is losslessly encoded.
Exactly.
Versus like an MP3, which is lossy.
So, and we can discuss more lossless and lossy. One term that I just became familiar with recently is the idea of transparency. And so when you talk about data compression, when you take that like WAV file, you compress it down to an MP3, you're actually losing some of that data, right? And that's why it's called lossy. Other audio encoding formats like FLAC, for example, these are lossless. And that means that all the original audio information is retained within the encoded file, only the file is smaller. And there's this idea of transparency. And what transparency is, that's when you have lossy data. So you have your MP3, but it's encoded at a high enough accuracy that the sound is actually undistinguishable from the uncompressed input. So you can't even tell that there's a difference. So for the MP3 format, it's generally considered that 192 KBS is transparent. So that will sound like an actual CD wave quality. And for a newer encoding format called AAC, Advanced Audio Codec, this is what iTunes uses. It's generally considered to be transparent at 128 KBS. And actually, some iTunes will actually use 256 KBS. So it's even more than what is actually transparent. So here you're starting to get an idea of there's so many different audio formats. There's like this standardized, accepted version of what CD sound sounds like or what audio from a DVD sounds like. And then there's this entire community of people who are pushing these like crazy, crazy high resolution audio. And that really just brings it back to the core question is, can someone actually perceive that difference?
Hey, Kevin, could I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
So right now you're throwing a lot of these numbers around and it seems like they're labels, right? They denote something, but could you maybe go into a little bit more detail about what the numbers actually mean and what they mean physically and maybe how we would expect that to relate to what we can hear or not?
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes down to like when we're talking about or even evaluating music quality, generally you talk about a bit rate. And so, for example, a song that's encoded at 128 is going to sound not as good as one that's encoded at 320, right? There's just a general rule that the larger the bit rate, the larger the file size, and the better the quality. All those things are true. But when you actually like dig deeper into it, there's a lot of other stuff you have to keep in mind. So first, let's talk about bit rate. What is bit rate? Bit rate is calculated from a couple different variables. The two that are the most important are the bit depth and the sample rate. And once we understand what those two things are, everything will kind of make sense. We'll understand why there is a difference between the standard quality, the 16-bit audio, and then the high-resolution audio, the 24-bit audio. So basically, bit depth is the number of levels or steps that contain a piece of audio. So it's kind of like a dynamic range. When you have a song Maybe there's really, really quiet parts, tiny whispers. And then later in the song, there's an extremely loud guitar riff or something like that. That range of volume is the bit depth. So a way to think about it, it's a number of levels or it's a number of steps in which the audio energy can be sliced up at any given time. So when you look at really low bit depth audio, like 4-bit depth, there's only there's only 16 integer values. So like when you record music at 4-bit depth, there's only 16 possible volumes for all of the music contained within that track. And every time you increase the bit depth, you get twice as many levels of sound. So the way that I tried to think about this, and I'm not sure if it will be helpful to the listeners, but the idea is that you're a coach on an Olympic team, and you have a bunch of athletes, and they're all participating in the high jump, and you're watching them jump up in the air. So as the athlete jumps in the air, and they go over the bar, and they come back down again. So if you were to measure their height off the ground, you could map it as like a peak, and then it would come back down again. So if your job is to analyze this particular person jumping, doing the high jump, you could record some video. And for every frame of that video, you could print it out on a piece of paper. And you could grab your ruler and you could measure how high that person is off the ground for each frame of the video. So let's say in this world, it's a world where it's a 4-bit depth audio world. So your ruler only has 16 little notches on it or gradations on it. So you go through all the frames and you measure that athlete's height as being 0, 1, 2, 3, up to 16. So you can imagine at the start of the jump, the person's on the ground. So they would have a bit, they'd be at level 0. At the highest point of the jump, they'd be at 16. Somewhere in between, they're at 8. But the question is, right when they take off and their feet have just left the ground, are they at level 0 or are they at level 1? They're actually somewhere in between, right? Because you don't have that resolution to say exactly where they are. And these little rounding errors, these are called quantization errors. And these effectively lead to noise in the recording. So when you have a recording and you record at really low bit depth, you hear more noise because there's more of these rounding errors. You can't actually say exactly how loud that particular sound is, because there's not enough levels to accurately describe that. I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean that helped. Yeah. The help clarify it for the bit levels, and then the sample rate is another part of it.
Right, exactly. So sample rate. Just one more comment. So in standard CD quality audio, we have 16-bit, and at 16-bit, because every bit that you increase, the number of levels doubles. With 16-bit audio, there's almost 66,000 possible levels instead of 16. And when you get wild and crazy up at 24-bit audio, there's about 17 million different levels. So you can imagine having that many different levels means that there's very, very few and very, very minor rounding errors. And maybe there's not like a perceptible difference between 16-bit and 24-bit because just the number of levels that you have.
And we have no way of saying how many levels there are in real life.
Well, real life is, I guess, analog, right? So there's no stair-stepping. Yeah. There's no need to define.
You're not making an approximation. You're not making. Yeah. You're not converting the analog data into digital data.
Okay.
So it's more continuous, basically.
So if you picture like a waveform, you know, in real life, that waveform can be perfectly smooth at all points. But when we digitize it and we have to turn it into ones and zeros, then we have to have...
Got to pixelate it.
Got to pixelate it, exactly. Picture like Mario on the original Nintendo as your low-quality audio. And Mario on the original Nintendo is your low-quality audio. Mario on a modern Nintendo is high-quality. And Mario in real life is your analog Mario.
Exactly.
I love how tentative
that
was.
Now exactly. So everyone on the high jumping team is also Mario.
Right. Yeah, so you got to picture Mario and a high jumping team.
No, that's it. I should have put Mario in the high jumping.
Yeah, like Mario jumping. how high, like how many rows of bricks are there on the little pipe he's got to jump over.
It also depends what power up you have. You got the cape, you can go pretty high.
Getting distracted.
I think so.
So what happens when we record late at night.
Yeah. I wanted to go back to sample rate real quick. So when we're talking about bit rate, there's the bit depth, which is how many levels there are, and then there's the sample rate. So the sample rate is the number of measurements you take every second. So if you were to think back to our Mario jumping over the high jump, it's in that example, it's the number of frames per second of your video, because I'm analyzing the height every second. So when you're doing an audio recording, you can actually get extremely high sample rate. So for CDs, it's about 41 kilohertz, so 41,000 samples per second. For DVDs, it's about 48,000 samples per second. And then when you get into the high resolution audio, it gets crazy up to, I mean, I'm not sure where it caps out on, but I've seen 192 kilohertz. So basically, when you take those two things together, the bit depth and the sampling rate, that gives you the bit rate. And generally, the bigger the bit rate, the more audio information you have in that file, the bigger the file is on your hard drive, and then the higher the audio quality.
So this study was looking at if people can actually tell the difference.
Exactly. So what it did, and this is a major discussion in both the like academic circles, but also online. Like if you go to these online forums, it's crazy. People are really heated about this issue because audiophile people who invest lots of money in higher end gear, they're very adamant that they can hear the difference. But some other individuals who maybe don't know quite as much about music or just have like generic headphones, the $5 headphones we talked about, maybe these kind of people can't hear the difference, and they would argue that there is no difference. So what's really important about this paper is it's a meta-analysis. He went through all the literature since 1980, identified a bunch of different papers and experiments, and then took that data and reanalyzed it and tried to look for a consensus on this topic of whether people can actually hear that difference. And what was great, I found an online audiophile forum about it, and someone was discussing this particular paper, and there's a quote here that says, "Did you really expect anything more from this intellectually dishonest placebophile apologist?"
Placebophile?
Which I thought was quite humorous. So someone's calling out the
So someone who likes author. Placebos.
So you can see, like, people are really, really passionate about this.
So he likes placebos, and he's apologizing for the fact that he likes placebos?
So a friend of the placebo expecting.
Oh. So he's looking for placebo effect, yeah.
Exactly.
Dumb.
Well, what is really funny about this comment is the person obviously didn't read the paper, because when we actually go through in the results, this paper is probably the single strongest evidence for audiophiles to justify their very expensive purchases.
And
we can go into that a little bit more very, very shortly in the results. So what I think is really cool about this paper is there have been other studies that investigate this sort of thing, but this is the very first paper to like really rigorously review all the literature that's already available on this subject and then do like a meta-analysis of that. And this kind of work, meta-analysis work, is really, really important and generally can be undervalued, because as a researcher, it's usually more exciting to like run new experiments and like do your own kind of research as opposed to doing statistical analysis or follow-up studies or trying to reproduce results from other people's work. So that's why I think this paper is even more important. So basically what he did is, in the first third of the paper, it's all methods stuff. I'm going to skip over it, but generally it explains why certain studies were considered and why certain studies were not considered. And there's lots of really cool information about the nature of human hearing, and why it may or may not be relevant to perceiving the benefits of high resolution audio. But just all in all, to summarize, the author started with 80 different studies that investigated discrimination between standard and high resolution audio since 1981, identified 21 potential studies to examine further, He contacted the authors of those studies, gathered all of their unpublished data, and of those 21, 18 were deemed to be suitable for this more in-depth meta-analysis. And so a lot of the different papers with different experiments used this particular type of test. It's called an ABX test. And this is the gold standard for measuring differences between audio samples. Basically how it works, it's a method of comparing two different choices of stimuli and to detect a difference between them. So subject is given two known samples, sample A and sample B. And then following that, they get an unknown sample, sample X. It's either A or B. And what the subject does is they have to identify if X is A or if X is B. And it's randomized each time. And what's great about this type of test, this ABX test, it's a double-blind test, which means that it's designed in a way to eliminate some of the effects of bias. Obviously, when you're running a test, you don't want the listener to have any clues as to which sample is which. Also, you don't want the person who's organizing the test to accidentally give the listener any clues, whether that's consciously or subconsciously. And so
you don't want the investigator to go, is it A or is it B?
Big thumbs down, B.
Yeah, big frowny face.
Yeah, and that's why this particular type of experiment, the ABX experiment, is really, really valuable in this when you're investigating differences between audio samples. And so another advantage of ABX is it helps eliminate the effect of chance. So when you're making a comparison between two things, it's basically like a 50-50, right? It's a coin flip. First I hear A, then I hear B, then I hear one of those two, I have a 50% chance of guessing it's right. But when you do this kind of experiment with repeated trials, we can make a calculation of the confidence level, which is how sure we are about the results of this experiment that it's not pure chance. And generally in science, we try to get a 95% confidence level. And luckily we have mathematics and statistics, which have basically mapped out, calculated the chance of an outcome or a series of outcome being pure chance. And you can look it up. I found a table just online called ABX binomial probability table. And it tells you the chance with increasing number of trials. What is the probability that that would be just purely a chance outcome?
So there's some nice weekend reading for everybody.
Yeah, there's a big table with a bunch of numbers.
So to clarify, we're not asking people which they prefer, A or B. We're just asking if they can distinguish between these things.
Yes.
Is this third thing A or was this third thing B?
Exactly. Yeah. So what he did, we'll jump into the results now. One more thing I should note. Just to be sure.
Man, you keep stringing us along.
Sorry. It's a huge payoff, trust me. Just to make sure that there were a few different experimental methods used in the other papers, but he did an analysis of the different methods used and found that there was no significant difference, although the effect was most visible in the ABX testing. So moving forward, he says this is definitely this is the strategy that we should use to investigate this effect further. So basically, the meta-analysis contained over 400 participants, 12,500 trials. It's all summarized in Table 2. And the take-home message is that from all of these people and all of these trials, 53% of listeners could accurately guess between the standard and the high-resolution audio. So it's a small effect. It's difficult to detect. But it does seem just barely people can detect the high resolution audio.
Oh, interesting. So if it was 50%, we would say that's chance.
Purely chance.
No effect at all. 53, there is something.
There is something. And it's interesting because it's kind of like an average of a population. There's not one individual who guessed 10 out of 10, who got it perfectly. The best one that I saw is someone did, I think, 7 out of 9. There was one individual who got it right 7 out of 9. And then three other individuals got it right like 6 out of 9 times.
Yeah, but that could be chance.
It could totally be chance, but there's no, at least in all of these studies, all of these participants, there's no person who has that magic golden ear that got it 100% right every single time.
But so it would be interesting to take those people who did above average and do a second study with just them to find out if that effect holds. Like, is there a difference in the listener, right? People who are actual audio geeks or
audiophiles, can they tell the difference? The next question that is asked by the author.
All right.
Beautiful segue. So the whole rest of the paper describes how all the data was analyzed. There's lots of statistics, which is, I'm not a data scientist, so it's way over my head. I just have to kind of trust him and take him at his word. But generally what they did is, there's two key observations here. When you break down all the participants from all the studies, you can break them down by gender, you can break them down by age, but one of the subgroups has a very interesting effect. And this is the trained versus untrained. Or another way of looking at it, it's the audiophile versus the non-audiophile population. And when he isolated these two groups, there was a much larger effect from those who received training compared to those who didn't. So this is in figure two, if you're following along at home. And when you look at figure two, you see that of the untrained listeners, they could give correct answers only 51% of the time. But the trained listeners gave correct answers 62% of the time. So wow. When you group them all together, you get that original 53% people get it correct. But when you break it down, trained listeners give significantly more correct answers than untrained listeners. So,
are you saying that the people on those audio, like, listservs are actually better than the rest of us?
On average, yes. They can hear, they're more adept at picking up differences between standard audio and high resolution audio.
Yeah, that makes me really
sad. Exactly what I would expect from such a sebophile apologist.
So that's really the take home message here, is that people who spend a lot of time listening to audio carefully, arguing on the forums, insulting scientists who are performing meta-analysis, these are the people who are more likely to be able to pick out that high-resolution audio. And this might be somewhat in line with, like, wine connoisseurs or cigar or whiskey connoisseurs who are able to, I guess, make a living out of detecting these subtle differences. And what's great about this paper is it's very rigorous. There's lots of statistics going on, a lot of data analysis. So they're very, very confident with these findings. Obviously, this isn't the be-all and the end-all. There's a lot more research that has to be done. But this is definitely like a really good starting point to kind of reset that conversation and establish some sort of scientific basis for people who are more who are into the more high-end gear and that kind of stuff.
It would be interesting to see if you took novices and gave them training and sort of made them into audiophiles, if that would affect their ability to tell the difference here. Or is it just that people who can tell the difference are more attracted to learning more about audiophiles?
So it's a bit, because there's so many different studies that are being analyzed at once, it's hard to specifically break that trained population down into specifically who are those that have more previous experience before the experiment, or whether they were trained during the experiment. So for an example of that is, many of the studies, the participants were actually trained during the experiment. They were given an explanation of what to listen for. They were given examples of artifacts that could be heard between a standard quality and a high quality. And some of them even had pretests where they were given kind of like results of exactly what to listen to. So within that population, there's people who are hardcore audiophiles, but also kind of normal participants that have received a little bit of training. And so recommendations from this paper going ahead in future studies is to provide that trained population with enough information so that they know what to listen to and what to try to pick out of those files out of those audio samples, and that will give a much more robust result.
So is the idea that basically we can do some sort of like pattern matching in our head, where there are these artifacts that come up if you're undersampled or if you're encoded weird. that would never occur in the real world. And so you can listen for those sorts of little patterns, those little blips or glitches in the sound. And that's what people most commonly identify? Or is there something else about the quality of the sound itself?
I think it's because these were all performed under really optimal listening conditions. This isn't like a test that you would perform in a cafe or out on the street or something. Everything was very tightly controlled. And the speakers were placed at certain distances and have certain frequencies and that sort of stuff. I think it's really those fundamental differences between the standard and the high audio quality that people are picking out and that they're able to identify.
But you need to sort of know what you're looking for or listening for.
And that's what this study showed. If you train them, they will have a higher chance of picking out those things. But if you don't tell them what to listen for, only 53% of the average person will guess correctly.
That's really interesting.
And that actually, that question brings up another point. All of these experiments were done with speakers. So none of the studies use headphones. So there's a big open question regarding how the presentation of the headphones or how the headphones might actually change the perception of the audio. And maybe something like blindfolding. Like when I was preparing for this, I downloaded this program. It's called FUBAR. And basically what it does is it's a media player, but there's a plugin that you can get and you can make your own ABX test. And I have a bunch of MP3s and some FLAC files, and I was listening to all these songs, like my favorite songs, over and over again. And I could not tell a difference. Like, I used to think I was so savvy with audio and all this sort of stuff, and I realized that I couldn't pick out between sort of lower quality MP3 and higher quality FLAC. And I wonder if it's my headphones aren't sophisticated enough, or I don't have proper equalization or something like that.
Well, yeah, a lot of what MP3s does, I believe, is that they just kind of cut out sections of frequency range, like really high frequency ranges that we don't really hear. That might be kind of like the sizzle you hear on a cymbal crash or something. That's kind of what gets lost because they're kind of less important frequency ranges. And if your headphones already don't reproduce those frequencies well, that could be an explanation for that.
And my understanding is that one of the major issues with the quantization errors is that it ends up causing this background like white noise in the audio. But I was trying to read more about how does a quantization error equal white noise. I didn't get that deep into it, but that's something that I'd really like to investigate more and try to understand. But there is some crazy audio physics stuff going on that is much more sophisticated than my very like layman understanding.
But the drawbacks to all this audiophile stuff is so huge. Don't you think you're better off just not knowing about it? like you got to go buy a Pono. You got to go download FLAC files. Like, because your favorite Spotify playlist to buy. Exactly.
Hey, but it's not even that specialized anymore. Right? Like, it could be the question of should I pay for Spotify Premium or not? You know, one of the things that they advertise is that you get access to higher bitrate audio if you pay for their services. I'm sure a lot of the Apple Music and Pandora and all these companies offer that as an option. So
yeah, but it's still streaming. It's still probably not going to come close to CD quality, let alone the stuff that
I mean
Kevin's talking about, which is even higher quality than
this
that.
This is true. Right? Even their extreme quality, as they seem to call it, is just 320 kilobits per second, which is high quality, but I think it's still compressed. And
the one that seems to have the highest, like the service that offers the highest resolution audio, from at least the research that I've done, seems to be the Pono. Pono? Am I saying that
Pono?
Right? P-O-N-O?
P-O-N-O.
Pono?
Pono. And it's kind of crazy how expensive it is. You can download albums, it's like between $10 and $25, and you get 24-bit, 192 kilohertz audio.
So, I have a question. So, CD compared to audiophiles, that's all digital. But what are, like, cassette tapes or vinyl?
Those are analog.
Oh, this is such a bag of worms, Jamie. Oh, my God. If you think the lossless versus lossy arguments are vicious, imagine the analog versus digital arguments about audiophile stuff. The hard argument with vinyl is that there is no conversion to ones and zeros. It's just, you know, a needle transferring directly to vinyl, and it's, you know, in theory has much higher bit rate, but this stuff is all controversial still.
Right. And magnetic tape on cassettes is the same way, right? It's all an analog conversion process. You're just using the physics. Yeah. You don't have to digitize it all.
Although,
okay, so yeah. Regular audio files are Mario pixelated. Real life is Mario, a guy in a Mario suit. Right. High quality is newest version of Nintendo. Would a vinyl or a cassette be like a painting of Mario?
No, it would be like meeting Mario himself.
No, I think it's like the cassette is a Polaroid photo of Mario, right? It's analog. Okay. There's no digital conversion, and a vinyl is like a high quality, like a 35mm camera photograph of Mario.
Okay.
This is so stupid.
Strong opinions there. Strong opinions there, and how you're grading it. But
vinyl, you mean?
Yeah, and I mean I like. Yeah, actually, no, I like vinyl.
I don't get the flack. I don't get the flack, folks. The people who download the lossless files, but the vinyl guys, I understand that. Like, there's a romance to, you know, pulling that record off and putting it down, and like I actually think that the degradation of the quality, like the hisses and pops, is probably a part of what makes it so special. You know, like when there's a bit of dust on it. You know, like I don't begrudge vinyl folks.
Oh no, it's a nostalgia. Definitely.
Exactly. Yeah.
One of my
there's nothing romantic about downloading FLAC files. Forget
one of my cousins has a player where it's like a tin disc, and you put it on this player and it plays music because like where they poked holes in the tin disc is the little needles go over it and it plays this like creepy turn of the century tinkling music.
Yeah, it's just like a music box basically, right?
What is it? Are there like is it are there little tines that are getting flicked, or is it actually?
I think it's little tines like that are getting flicked,
vibrating it. Yeah,
yeah. Like it's real old timey.
It's funny because I recorded on an album and we spent a lot of time listening to the recordings in the sound booth on all this super high quality gear, like, you know, recording quality, digital stuff, and then listening to it over and over on these nice speakers where like the frequency responses are all equalized, so you supposedly have a nice flat response. You hear like the pure essence of the sound in all its raw character. And now, right, and then you mix it and you go through all this process to make it sound exactly the way you want to release it to people. And now, you know, I've got the super high quality versions on my computer that I could listen to if I wanted to. But I can also stream the album on Spotify. And I mean, if I'm testing a new set of headphones, I, you know, maybe I'll use the higher quality version to like reduce any question of whether or not there are any sort of MP3 type errors in the sound, issues in the sound. But for day-to-day listening, I, at the end of the day, I'm perfectly happy listening to it on Spotify too, with, you know, whatever streaming quality they give me.
When you say you recorded an album, were you like a musician on the album?
Yeah, I was a musician I played clarinet on the album.
Well, that's badass.
It's pretty fun. Yeah, it's a fun experience.
Yeah, and it's a death metal album, surprisingly.
I was just about to ask that. Like, death metal clarinet would be so badass.
I think you have to get a bass clarinet for death metal.
What is the genre, Thanasi?
It's kind of jazzy, jazzy world music, I'd say. A friend of mine composed all the pieces for it, and inspired, like, based on kind of ideas in Arabic music. So built around Arabic scales, but not really like any traditional music. It's a lot more jazz influenced.
Are there like quarter tones in it?
There are. Yeah, there are a lot of quarter tones in it. Quarter tones are.
Well, can we put the link to that?
Absolutely.
With this podcast.
Yeah, the album is called Quarter to Midnight.
Ooh.
I will use any opportunity for a shameless plug.
Do you have like a solo or anything? Can we pick you out?
Oh yeah, I'm the only clarinetist. It's fairly small ensemble work. So We had a string quartet, but other than that, there were like seven others of us.
All right, I'm going to take that, and I'm going to go to that ABX site and make myself a Thanasi ABX test.
Yeah, get the high-resolution FLAC, the lossless, and then encode a lossy MP3 and see if you can tell the difference. I was so...
That's my Saturday night. Yeah.
You know, I was thinking this would actually also be like the perfect episode to be to do audio editing while we're talking, to stand out and say, and this is what happens when you cut the bass response or when you boost the treble response, kind of Radiolab style.
You know, this is hubris doing a podcast about audio quality.
Oh, it's absolutely.
This is not the world's best sounding show. All of us recording on our various mics in our various parts of the world.
Someone should have warned me before I came on here, and I was like, I just bought headphones at the grocery store.
Just final thoughts. Is there a perceivable difference between standard and high resolution? Yes. Can the average person hear it under ideal conditions? Sort of, 53%. Is it worth buying those extremely expensive high resolution headphones? It depends.
All right. Well, that's our show. As always, you can find the show notes in your podcasting app, of course, or if you go to our website, usefulscience.org/podcast/19, you get the show notes there, and we will include the links to the articles we've talked about, and of course, we'll include a link to Thanasi's music. And we always appreciate your feedback and your comments. You can email us at podcast@usefulscience.org, and you can reach us on Twitter @usefulsci. My name is Cameron. You can follow me if you want to @usonic, EUSONIC.
I'm Thanasi, and you'll be able to find info about my music in the show notes.
I've forgotten my Twitter handle. Oh, you can follow me on Twitter @KevinNybert.
And I'm Jamie. You can follow me @JK_divine on Twitter.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a very useful week. You're listening to Jesus.
You're listening to Jesus.
A little rusty.
'Tis the season.
You know, when you only do this once every 2 to 12 months, it's hard to develop competency. Okay.